dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 536 of Unwelcome Guests, Beyond Hierarchy. I'm Robin Upton. It was a year ago that Lynn Gerry posted her last new Unwelcome Guests episode, number 500, so to mark the occasion, I thought I'd do something a bit different this week. This is not two or three speakers carefully introduced, but 20 or 30 without introduction, although if you're a regular listener to the show, you should probably be recognising most of them. And it's set to music. I've called it an audio collage, and of course I'm always appreciative of feedback, especially so this new format. You can contact me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. The theme is certainly a familiar one, the need to escape from patterns of domination and 20th century thinking structures. It's largely based on a video collage which I found on the web that was posted by Jonathan Shockley, so thanks to him, and he's going to start by introducing why he made it.
My interest in doing a video collage explaining anti-authoritarian principles and ideas started a few months ago after posting two videos on YouTube in which I ask people questions such as,
would you ever grant anyone the power to deny you the things you need to survive?
No.
Or to deny you the things you need to survive?
Oh no, that's just crazy.
No, not only would I not grant that power, I would fight any attempt to take that power.
Would you prefer to not have a boss?
Of course.
Now, if you had enough money to live comfortably the rest of your life, would you still do something productive or creative for the community?
Of course I would. Because you know why? The community is where I come from.
If you had enough money to live comfortably the rest of your life, would you still do something productive or creative for the community?
Yes.
Now, would you prefer to not have a boss?
Yes.
If you had enough money to live comfortably the rest of your life, would you still do something productive or creative for the community?
Absolutely.
Now, would you prefer to not have a boss?
Absolutely.
Would you prefer to not have a boss?
Yeah, who wouldn't?
I was surprised that most of the hundreds of people I asked said they did not want to have a boss or anyone with the power to deny them the things they need to survive, and that they wanted to do something productive and creative for the community without the profit incentive. I wondered what these kinds of psychological tendencies meant, what their origin is, and how they are being suppressed in our society.
Hierarchy as it exists in the family. Hierarchy as it exists in the school. Hierarchy as it exists in sexual relationships. Hierarchy as it exists between ethnic groups. Not only class divisions based upon economic exploitation. Domination which may not even have any economic meaning at all. The domination of women by men in which women are not economically exploited. The domination of ordinary people by bureaucrats, in which you may even have a welfare, so-called socialist type of state.
The first step to agriculture is the shift to control. It's the shift away from taking what nature supplied, the move to extort from nature, to colonize nature, to engineer nature, contains the other stuff. It's implicit. You will get to the genetic engineering and the total control sooner or later if you don't break that logic.
Where any other person would die of thirst in a few days, they live quite contentedly in this desert that doesn't look like a desert. They know where to dig for roots and bulbs and tubers, and which berries and pods are good to eat. And of course, they know what to do about water. For instance, in the early morning, you can collect dewdrops from leaves that were carefully laid out the previous evening. Or a plume of grass can be a reservoir. And if you have the know-how, an insignificant clump of twigs can tell you where to dig. Then you come to light with an enormous tuber. You scrape shavings off it with a stick that was split to give it a sharp edge. You take a handful of the shavings, point your thumb at your mouth, and squeeze. In this world of theirs, nothing is bad or evil. Even a poisonous snake is not bad. You just have to keep away from the sharp end. Actually, a snake is very good. In fact, it's delicious. And the skin makes a fine pouch. Sometimes Kiko tells about the time when he went to look for the end of the earth and about the strange heavy people he met on his journey. In the mornings, they like to read the news. They can read that the hyena has a new girlfriend, that the cheetah has lost one of her babies, that the oryx are starting to migrate to the west. The older children teach the younger ones how to read all the gossip about their neighbors, the animals, because everything that happens in the Kalahari gets printed out in the sand. They're very gentle people. They'll never punish a child or even speak harshly to it. So, of course, those kids are extremely well-behaved, and their games are cute and inventive. When the family needs meat, the hunter dips his tiny arrow in a brood that acts as a tranquilizer. So when he shoots a buck, it only feels a sting, and the arrow drops out. The buck runs away, but soon it gets very drowsy, and it stops running. After a while, it goes to sleep. And the hunter apologizes to his prey. He explains that his family needs the meat. The one characteristic which really makes the Bushmen different from all the other races on Earth is the fact that they have no sense of ownership at all. They must be the most contented people in the world. They have no crime, no punishment, no violence, no laws, no police, judges, rulers, or bosses. Only 600 miles to the south, there's a vast city. And here you find civilized men.
Vince Lombardi's famous comment, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," must be understood not merely as the expression of one football coach's fanaticism, but as a capsule description of our entire culture. Our lives are not merely affected by, but structured upon, the need to be better than. We seem to have reached a point where doing our jobs, educating our children, and even relaxing on the weekends have to take place in the context of a struggle where some must lose. That there might be other ways to do these things is hard for us to imagine, or rather, it would be hard if we were sufficiently reflective about our competitiveness to think about alternatives in the first place. Mostly we just accept it as the way life is. Mr. Cohn, isn't life that way?
Well, life in this culture certainly is that way. From our earliest days, we are trained not only to compete, but to believe in competition, to believe it's necessary for productivity, to believe that it builds character, and even to believe that it's inherent to being human, that it's built into our nature. Life itself doesn't have to be that way. We may be driven innately to achieve, to prosper, to survive, but those don't have to be construed as activities we do against other people, trying to beat them. That is a cultural prejudice, and I know of no other culture which drives the point home in such an exaggerated fashion as our own.
But if you are a cultural determinist, and you seem to be, aren't you spitting against the wind in writing the book and looking at this as the case against competition? How can you possibly establish that case in a culture that functions as you say ours does?
Well, I would not describe myself as a cultural determinist. I would suggest that we learn lessons like competition and cooperation rather than having that be a part of our genetic code, for example. There is no evidence for the latter proposition. But I think that all institutions in a given culture can be changed. It was only a generation ago, I think, that we faced what seemed to be an insurmountable barrier toward equality of opportunity for all races. Racism seemed to be something that was not only part of our attitudes and personal psychology, but also built into the structures and institutional fabric of the American culture. Slowly we have begun to make progress there, and I argue we can do the same thing with competition. The first step is to understand that what we have been led to believe about competition is false. It is, in fact, counterproductive in the workplace and the classroom. It's psychologically destructive rather than constructive, and it poisons our relationships. If those things are true, if it's undesirable and it's unnecessary, then I think we can begin to make those changes in all arenas where it poisons us.
You say undesirable and unnecessary,
mm-hmm.
but haven't we decided as a people, hasn't our culture decided, isn't it built upon the notion that in terms of economics, it is desirable and it is necessary?
I think in economics, as, for example, in the classroom, we are certainly very competitive, and I'm not sure who the we is. I always get a little... Should we say they? Well, I mean, there's a problem, whether it's first person or third person, about reifying, treating the culture as if it is a single thing, an entity over which we can have no control. Maybe that, in fact, defines a cultural determinist, and that's why I don't put myself in that camp. We can begin to question the assumptions on which competition is based. We are led to believe that people would not be moved to work at all to reach excellence unless they are trying to make other people into losers. The evidence suggests otherwise. We're led to believe that it makes people feel more confident about themselves, that it builds character or enhances self-esteem. Again, the research actually shows us that that's quite wrong. So if we have the capability for reevaluating our behaviors and our attitudes, then we ought to look at what the data actually show. And then we can begin to make changes as parents, as teachers, as managers, as workers.
Yes, but what puzzles me, and I'm not arguing the point with you, but I'm truly curious about this. You seem to take the schoolroom, you take the classroom, you take schools and say, we can make this change. Do you feel the same about competition in the marketplace, where indeed it would seem in a period, certainly, of limited resources, that if I win in my competition with you, you will lose? Isn't that the basic assumption? And if it is, can it be set aside?
It is the basic assumption of this economic system, yes. I cannot imagine the American economic system as currently defined devoid of competition. If we take the lessons about competition and how unproductive it turns out to be to their logical conclusion, I think it requires some radical rethinking about an economic system. The question is then, do we best produce and distribute resources? And by best, I mean not only most productively, but most equitably, by having people try to defeat one another.
I mean, if the people want to be told, here's what I'm going to do for you, they're starting off on the wrong foot. They have to be encouraged to think for themselves what they want.
Well, to be fair to them, I mean, they did. They gave me quite a grilling.
Okay, that's good. And your role as a leader should be to eliminate yourself.
It should be to?
Eliminate yourself.
Maybe that could become one of my things. I could say that this country will be fully operational the day I become not king, but a citizen.
I think you get a decent society if, in fact, it doesn't rely on leaders.
So I'm just there, you know.
It's not saying that it shouldn't select representatives.
Well, maybe I can do that. Maybe I can get some, when I decide on, you know, when I can get some kind of representatives, or I can delegate some responsibility for specific departments.
Well, what I would suggest is instead of you delegating it, that they delegate it. Mm. It should be the task of the people involved to determine what tasks have to be undertaken, but the point is it's all from below.
And maybe I can use the internet, you know, for voting.
It isn't just voting, it's also participation and discussion and interchange.
So regular meetings would be good, regular kind of meetings where they can ask questions.
And come up with proposals.
Mm.
on every whatever issue it is.
In the barbers' shops were anarchist notices. The barbers were mostly anarchists, solemnly explaining that barbers were no longer slaves. In the streets were colored posters appealing to prostitutes to stop being prostitutes. The anarchists were still in virtual control of Catalonia, and the revolution was still in full swing. It was the first time that I had ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying that it had been collectivized. Even the bootblacks had been collectivized. Waiters and shop workers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. Nobody said señor or don or even usted. Everyone called everyone else comrade and thou, and said salud instead of buenos dias. You saw very few destitute people and no beggars except the gypsies. Above all, there was a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. Human beings were trying to behave as human beings and not as cogs in the capitalist machine.
A swift look at history reveals a colossal amount of evil and suffering in the world. Throughout history, people have tried to identify and understand its primary cause. Explanations have ranged from the corrupting influence of artificial institutions to the intrinsic wickedness of human nature to the workings of the devil and evil spirits or of certain groups such as royal families, capitalists, communists, slave owners, atheists, deists, Jews, Freemasons, etc. While it would be impossible to attribute all the evil of the world to one cause, there seems to be a concept that is quite central to most manifestations of it. Hierarchy, a form of organization in which people or groups are ranked one above another according to status or authority. This is tied to a violation of a basic moral principle. Those who have or seek more power than others do not apply to themselves the same standards they apply to others. Obviously, one cannot say that all authority is evil, particularly non-exploitive, challengeable, and accountable authority that allows people to survive or grow. However, hierarchical authority is inextricably connected with the marginalization and disempowerment of those without authority, with a lack of control over their actions and destinies, and with the subsequent rationalization of one's place in the pecking order. This not only arouses instincts which predispose people to cruelty and indifference in the face of the suffering of their fellows, but it interferes with honest communication between people at different levels of power and turns people into subordinates, following orders from above regardless of their effect on others. Given that evolutionary biology has proven that mutual aid is more important for survival than competition, it is not surprising that the massive structures of hierarchy and competition we've created in recent civilized history have now come to endanger our survival and that of many other species. In the modern era, if we count the number of crimes, for example, the number of people killed and the amount of money stolen by elite hierarchical institutions like governments and corporations, and compare it to the smaller criminals like bank robbers, serial killers, gangs, Islamic terrorists, etc., it is not even close. Furthermore, evidence shows that, contrary to popular belief, the institutions of power that shape the law do not restrain criminal behavior, but actually promote the alienation, violence, and socioeconomic disparity that create most of these smaller criminals.
Good morning, Worm, Your Honor. The crown will plainly show the prisoner who now stands before you was caught red-handed showing feelings of an almost human nature. This will not do.
Call the schoolmaster! Robert J. Lifton wrote this great, great book called The Nazi Doctors. And
he asked the fundamental question, how could people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath work in death camps? And the answer he came up with by interviewing them was really, really extraordinary, which is that many of the doctors, and he's not talking about Mengele or the people like him, he was talking about, you know, sort of the average doctors in the death and work camps. And what he found was that many of them actually did everything they could to make things better for the Jews and other inmates in the camps. Everything within their power, except question the larger concentration camp. So they would give someone who was in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick. They would hide them from people making selections. They would, selections for murder. They would do all these things. They would do everything except question the concentration camp. And so often, and I say this as a long-term grassroots environmental activist, you know, I'm not throwing stones, you know, I'm throwing stones at a rubber wall that are bouncing back and hitting me in the face here, that what we do so often is we do everything we can to save this or that piece of ground, except question the larger picture. And so what we end up doing is it becomes incredibly difficult. How are we going to save salmon? Well, I guess the question we're really asking is, how are we going to save salmon without taking out dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the oceans, without stopping global warming? How are we going to do it when we put on all those constraints? How are we going to keep the inmates alive without breaking down the f***ing walls? I'm not interested anymore in keeping the inmates alive. I'm interested in breaking down the f***ing walls.
Back in the 1990s in Italy, there was a teeny little laboratory, and they were studying macaque monkeys, and they had MRIs on the monkey. So one monkey, they're watching how the hand movements try to open up a nut. And the monkey's getting frustrated, trying to open the nut, and certain neurons light up in the brain. Nothing much going on. By sheer happenstance, a trainer walks in a few minutes later and takes the nut, not knowing, and tries to open it up himself. Same emotions, feelings, and frustrations. The monkey's just looking at him, not moving. But all of a sudden, the same neurons lit up when he was observing the trainer as when he was going through the feelings himself. And they said, what is this? It took a few more years. They started putting MRIs on other primates. And they started to see when a primate would see another primate observe their pain or their pleasure or their angst, the same neurons would light up as if they were feeling it themselves. Then they put it on humans and found the same thing. They discovered mirror neurons across the primate kingdom. Now we think the elephants have them because of self-identity, maybe even dogs. We've discovered empathy wired in to social creatures, and every parent knows this. When that little baby's looking up to you, they're looking to belong, they're looking for intimacy. And then around 2 years of old, they explore, they're looking for universality. Intimacy and universality. We seek universal intimacy. That's the awe and angst of the human race. Empathy is a very strange phenomenon. It's what makes civilization. To civilize is to empathize. If I empathize with you, it means I've created enough sense of myself that I know I'm a person. I'm individual from my tribal connection. I feel the angst of my life. I'm going to live and die. I can smell my mortality. And then when I feel your plight, your pain, or your pleasure, I understand you have one time around. This is your life. And I try to root for you and celebrate and feel your pain or pleasure as if it's my own. Because we understand mortality, life and death, and each person's desire to flourish and be. We can do it with a fellow creature. Many of us do it with our companion animals. As civilization becomes more complex, selfhood becomes more differentiated, and we can feel more of an ability to empathize across more diverse kingdoms. The good news, we are extending empathy now to the whole world. This younger generation is connected. When that young college student in Iran, who was a pre-med student, was gunned down after the Iran elections, in 20 minutes on Twitter, an entire generation was in tears. because they totally identified with this young girl. So we have the technology now that connects the human race. We can begin to extend this notion of civilization to an empathic civilization. If we have an empathic civilization, we're going to be able to reheal the planet. Because when we extend empathy to all of our fellow human beings and all of our fellow creatures as if they were ourselves, there's no more self-interest, there's only our united interest. We regain our sense of individuality because you can't empathize without being an individual. But we connect ourselves in a more integrated way. Does this make sense? So we need an empathic civilization to move a third industrial revolution. We need to retell the story, and it's the great urban areas that tell the human story. So in these great urban areas, you go back and not only build a third industrial revolution, but help us retell the human journey. Rethink human nature. We are born to be an empathic being. And if we're violent and aggressive and self-interested, it's because the initial attachment didn't connect. And everything else is a substitute. What we really want to do is we want the companionship and sociability of life. The worst thing you can do to a person is ostracize them.
Hey you, out there in the cold, getting lonely, getting old, can you feel me? Hey you, standing in the aisles with itchy feet and fainting smiles, can you feel me? Hey you, don't help them to bury the lie.
It's a fair assumption that every flesh and blood human being is a moral person. You know, we've got the same genes, we're more or less the same. But our nature, the nature of humans, allows all kinds of behavior. I mean, every one of us, under some circumstances, could be a gas chamber attendant and a saint. You want to distinguish between the institution and the individual. So slavery, for example, or other forms of tyranny, are inherently monstrous. But the individuals participating in them may be the nicest guys you can imagine. Benevolent, friendly, nice to their children, even nice to their slaves, caring about other people. I mean, as individuals, they may be anything. In their institutional role, they're monsters because the institution's monsters.
I did a study of Vietnam veterans in the early 1970s, and I learned a lot from that study, and it has a lot of bearing on what's going on in Iraq right now. I came upon the idea of what I called an atrocity-producing situation. What that meant, very simply, was that an ordinary GI, no better or worse than you or me, could walk into a structure that would cause him quickly to commit atrocities. It had to do with the structure of an anti-insurgency war and the psychology of being fearful and losing buddies, and feeling one's life in danger and not being able to line up the enemy. That's the classic structure of a counterinsurgency struggle.
You know, you see a starving child and you can steal food from him and there's no policeman around. Very few people would do it. If they would do it, they're really pathological. I mean, there's some pathological extremes, but ordinarily people wouldn't behave like that. They do behave like that on a massive scale. Massive scale. But they're unaware of it, and there's a huge indoctrination system designed to make them unaware of it, and even to make them think that the starving child is stealing from them, you know, so we're the victims. That's what propaganda and regimentation are all about, and, you know, it sort of works, and it erodes the moral character. It prevents you from looking at what you yourself are doing or what your leaders are doing and worry about somebody else. So you see that all the time. So the people can be very moral, but they're acting within institutional structures, constructed systems in which only certain options are easy to pursue.
My name is Linda Pino. I am here primarily today to make a public confession. In the spring of 1987, as a physician, I denied a man a necessary operation that would have saved his life and thus caused his death. No person and no group has held me accountable for this, because in fact, what I did was I saved a company a $500,000 for this. And furthermore, this particular act secured my reputation as a good medical director, and it ensured my continued advancement in the healthcare field. I went from making a few hundred dollars a week as a medical reviewer to an escalating six-figure income as a physician executive. In all my work, I had one primary duty, and that was to use my medical expertise for the financial benefit of the organization for which I worked.
God, yeah, like one time I had a couple, and they were so happy to get, I start crying, they were so happy that they were, that I took them to this application. And the husband was late for work, and the wife said to him, well, don't worry, baby, it's gonna be okay, because we have health insurance now. And when I looked at the end of the application, I could tell they were both going to get declined because of their health conditions. And they were so happy. And I thought, oh God, they're going to get that phone call in a couple weeks telling them that they're not eligible for insurance. And I just felt so bad because I just really thought, and I knew, and I couldn't say anything to them. I just felt like crap. And that's why I'm just such a bitch on the phone to people, because I don't want to get to know them. I don't want to know about their lives. I just want to get in and get out and get done with it, because I can't take the stress of it.
I said to my wife, you know, we both are sons and daughters of auto workers in Flint, Michigan. There isn't a single one of us back in Flint, any of us, including us, who ever stopped to think, this thing we do for a living, the building of automobiles, is probably the single biggest reason why the polar ice caps are going to melt and end civilization as we know it. There's no connect between, I'm just an assembler on an assembly line building a car, which is good for people in society. It moves them around. But never stop to think about the larger picture and the larger responsibility of what we're doing.
Most of the evil in the world comes about not out of evil motives, but somebody saying, hey, you know, get with the program, be a team player. When a person feels, I am not personally responsible, I am not accountable, it's the role I'm playing, or these are the orders I've gotten, then you allow yourself to do things you would never do under ordinary circumstances.
Reports from the Stanford Prison Experiment, in which ordinary students were randomly allocated to be either pretend prisoners or pretend prison guards. It was stopped after 6 days due to ethical concerns. An experiment has noted that approximately one-third of the guards had exhibited genuine sadistic tendencies.
I began to feel that I was losing my identity, that the person that I call Clay, the person who put me in this place, the person who volunteered to go into this prison, because it was a prison to me, it still is a prison to me. I don't look on it as an experiment or a simulation. It's just a prison that was run by psychologists instead of run by the state.
I had really thought that I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was surprised, I was dismayed to find out that I could really be a that I could act in a manner so absolutely unaccustomed to anything I would even really dream of doing. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel any regret. I didn't feel any guilt. It was only afterwards, when I began to reflect on what I had done, that this behavior began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was a part of me I hadn't really noticed before.
I feel really up inside. You don't know. I gotta go. To a doctor, anything. I can't stay in there. I'm f***ed up. I don't know how to explain it. I'm f***ed up inside. Help me out! Help me out now! God damn it. I'm f***ed up. You don't know. You don't know. I mean, God. I mean, Jesus Christ, I'm burning up inside. Don't you know? I just f***ing can't take it.
The scene you just saw was at the end of only 36 hours into the study. Each day after that, another prisoner had a similar reaction. And so at the end of 5 days, we had five kids. Kids we chose because they were normal and healthy, having emotional breakdowns.
You put a uniform on and are given a role, I mean, a job, saying your job is to keep these people in line, then you're not certainly not the same person as if you're in street clothes and in a different role. You really become that person once you put on that khaki uniform, you put on the glasses, you take the nightstick, and, you know, you act the part. That's your costume, and you have to act accordingly when you put it on.
It harms me.
Why?
I mean harms. I mean in the present tense, it harms me.
How did it harm you? How does it harm you? Just to think about it, you mean that people can be like that?
Yeah. It let me in on some knowledge that I've never experienced firsthand. I've read about it. I've read a lot about it. But I've never experienced it firsthand. I've never seen someone turn that way. And I know you're a nice guy. You know?
Do
you understand? I do. I do know you're a nice guy.
I don't get bad
because I know what you can turn into.
It surprised me that no one said anything to stop me. No one said, Carmen, you can't say those things to me. Those things are sick. Nobody said that. They just accepted what I said. I said, you know, go tell that man to the face he's the scum of the earth. And they'd do it without question. They'd do push-ups without question. They'd sit in the hole. They'd abuse each other. And here they're supposed to have a little bit, they're supposed to be together as a unit in jail. But here they're abusing each other because I requested them to. And no one questioned my authority at all. And it really shocked me. Why didn't people, when I started to get abused people so much, I started to get so profane that, and still people didn't say anything.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing.
As soon as I realized that 819 could hear this, I rushed to the room where I had left him. And what I found was a boy crying hysterically, while in the background his fellow prisoners were chanting and yelling that he is a bad prisoner and that they were being punished because of him.
Because of what prisoner 819 did, myself is the best. Because of what prisoner 819 did, myself is the best.
Well, I'm trying to comfort this young man, and he says, I have to go back. And I said, what do you mean? I have to prove to them I'm not a bad prisoner. And at this point, I say, no, you're not a bad prisoner. You're Stu, and I'm not the superintendent. I'm Phil Zimbardo. The study is over. And he kept saying, no, I have to go back. I'm not a bad prisoner. So the reality of that prison was so deep that even when I'm giving him the opportunity to leave, his reputation, his image as a bad prisoner has to be undone, has to be reconciled. Yeah, when we released the first prisoner, 8612, we brought in a substitute, but he came in halfway through. And what's interesting is, day by day, as the situation degraded, we all adjusted to it. That is, each day's level of violence, of abuse, was a platform for the next day. But he comes in now, and he's seeing these crazy things going on. He says right up front, I'm not having any of this. And they told him, you can't leave. They won't let you leave, which we never said. In fact, 8612 was the one who told him, they won't let you out. And so he says, I'm going to go on a hunger strike. I'm not going to eat anything. I'll get sick, and they'll have to let me go. And he's a skinny kid to begin with. And the guards go crazy because he's now the symbol of resistance. All the other kids are broken. If they're not having emotional breakdowns, they're like zombies. They're doing whatever the guard said. And for the next 2 days, every guard on every shift, their mission is get this prisoner to eat those damn sausages. They put him in solitary confinement. They make him hold the sausages. And to his credit, he resists. So he should have been the hero. He should have been the hero for the other prisoners. Instead, he becomes a troublemaker. The guards set the other prisoners against him. They said, if he doesn't eat the sausages, you don't get your visiting hours. If he doesn't eat the sausages, you guys don't get your blankets. If he doesn't eat the sausages, we're going to put your blankets in nettles and spurs, and you're going to spend hours digging them out. So they start jumping all over him. Eat the damn sausages. You know, you're ruining our life.
It happens that that's the way states operate. Some of them can get away with it, the more powerful ones.
Most of them can't get away with it. Maybe they'd like to, but Luxembourg can't handle it, you know, or Andorra. But countries like the United States can. A powerful state does not want authorization because that weakens its power. If you have to have authorization from someone, you are not powerful enough to do anything you choose. The same reason why the Mafia Don does not want a court order.
In a week, I'm going to make him an offer again.
Suppose some Mafia Don isn't being paid by a, you know, some guy, a grocer or something. He doesn't go after a court order to get the money. He doesn't want a court order. He wants to send his goons in to beat him to a pulp, you know? That's called credibility.
If we were to leave before the mission is complete, it would hurt U.S. credibility.
If this little nation goes down the drain, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
I still have the right on now. I think let wrong people get a problem. Well, no, I just your mom. That's it. Then it would just be too much. No problem. I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sake.
So the Cold War, in effect, was a war of the United States against the Third World and of Russia against its much smaller domains in Eastern Europe. Each great power used the other's threats as a pretext. The major objectives in Vietnam are pretty much what they were in Cuba, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Congo, all around the world. They were afraid that Vietnam was going to undergo successful social and economic development, and as it's put in high places, the rot might spread to others. It might lead to ideological victories for the mode of socioeconomic development that they're pursuing. The virus might infect others, as Kissinger put it with regard to Chile. Well, when you have a virus, what do you do with it? You kill the virus and you inoculate the potential victims, and that's what happened. Indochina was killed. Maybe it'll survive, but it's not going to be a model for anything. And the surrounding region was inoculated. In the 60s and early 70s, the U.S. succeeded in installing brutal and vicious military dictators in every country. And that stopped the prevented the rot from spreading.
I always found when in any discussion on war, inevitably, in any discussion on war, at a certain point in the discussion, somebody would say, oh, well, it's human nature.
One of the problems that the Army found after World War II was that only 20% of soldiers in combat situations fired their weapons. So the question was, how do we raise that firing rate? And they brought in Army psychologists to do it, and instead of using bullseye targets, they created human targets that pop up and down. And they employed the techniques in operant conditioning, in essence, the same techniques you use to train a dog, to train people to overcome this natural reluctance most of us have to killing. They know how long you can stand sustained combat, which is 60 days. After 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of a unit will have a psychological breakdown or collapse. And that 2% that does not, according to this study, shows a predisposition to aggressive psychopathic personalities. So in other words, after 60 days of combat, you either go crazy or you were crazy to begin with.
Well, first of all, from my own experience, and I still have to tell this to people because there are still people who talk about the desire of young men to go to war, the thrill it is for young men to be in war, to shoot their guns, to kill. And I thought about my own experience in the Air Force, and it was very clear to me, looking around at all these guys around me who were dropping bombs and who were killing people, it did not come from inside. It did not come from, oh, God, how good it would be to kill some people today. You know, there was no urge to kill, even though they were the enemy. No, what it came from was simply we had been trained.
And basic training anywhere is always the same. It happened to me when I joined the Navy 20 years ago.
The recruit is stripped of all evidence of his civilian identity, his hair, his clothes, everything that makes him look and feel like an individual. Marine basic training is more extreme than in most armies, but essentially what's happening to these teenagers here is happening to other 18-year-olds all over the world at the same time. They're entering a machine which turns out a very special and artificial product, soldiers.
Paris Island prides itself in being one of the finest training facilities, organizations in the entire world. The United States Marine Corps has 205 years of illustrious history to speak for itself. You're trying to be a member of that organization. You have made the most important decision you have in your life up to this period in time by signing your name, your life, your pledge to the government of the United States of America. Even more importantly, the United States Marine Corps, a brotherhood, an elite unit. In 10.3 weeks, you are going to become a member of that history, those traditions, this organization, if you have what it takes. All of you want to do that by virtue of you signing your name as a man. The Marine Corps says, and we say in the Marine Corps, that we build men. Well, I'll go a little bit further. We develop the tools that you have, and everybody has those tools to a certain extent right now. We're going to give you the blueprints, and we are going to show you how to build a Marine. You've got to build a Marine, do you understand?
Yes, sir! Get up! Get up!
All right, no!
Get up!
Hurry up! Hurry up!
They've been given their uniforms and their shots, and their first day of real training is beginning. It's 5 o'clock in the morning.
Senior Staff Sergeant Webb, I am motivated, truly dedicated, rocking, stomping, blood test, kill face, United States Marine Corps recruits, sir.
What they're saying is that this barracks contains 45 highly motivated, truly dedicated, rompin', stompin', bloodthirsty, kill-crazy United States Marine Corps recruits, sir. And they'll chant it every morning for the next 70 days.
And also we have been told it's a good war. We've been told we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. It's be bad if they won, it'll be good if we win. We've got to drop the bombs. And then when I got away from my own experiences and just began to study history and history of wars, something else became clear to me. And that is, wars don't take place out of the rush of a population demanding war. It isn't the population that demands war, it's the leaders who demand war and who prepare the population for war.
The vanquished know war. They see through the empty jingoism of those who use the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. They know the lies the victors often do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives filled with stories of courage and comradeship. They know the lies that permeate the thick, self-important memoirs by amoral statesmen who make wars but do not know war.
Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction.
Saddam Hussein is determined to get his hands on a nuclear bomb.
Nuclear weapon.
Nuclear weapon.
Nuclear weapon.
Active chemical munitions, bunkers, mobile production facilities.
We know he's got chemical weapons. He's got them.
He's got them.
He's got them.
And it was clear to me from looking at the works of anthropologists, there were some tribes that were fierce and some tribes that were peaceful. It clearly wasn't a universal quality. It depended on the conditions under which they lived. And this guy, Colin Turnbull, wrote books about the forest people and the mountain people. And the forest people, the pygmies of the forest, lived under the kind of conditions which made them violent. The people in the mountains were living under different kinds of conditions, and they were peaceful. So No, I just didn't see any scientific evidence. And also the word aggression is a very ambiguous term, because you can take out your aggressions in many ways. You don't have to take it out by killing people.
But what we have in history is the fact that when surplus value develops, when there's more than a subsistence economy, you have some portion of the population that will do everything it can to enslave and to expropriate the labor of the rest of the people. And one of the things that's used in that arrangement is a very conscious instrument of control.
Don't chase me, bro! Don't chase me! I can't do it! Ow! Ow! Ow!
An organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate uses of force and violence. And that instrument is called the state.
This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated, hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable, and when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. I mean, there's a whole culture worth of examples of this. You know, my own father was extremely violent. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time, because my brother had committed blasphemy. The violence had gone up the hierarchy, which it should never do. Another example of this would be, Jaws or Spring Break Shark Attack. It was a movie made like a year and a half ago. I was like, God, I wish there was that many sharks still in the world. You know, I watched Jaws about the same time I watched Star Wars. And, you know, I'm still kind of afraid to get in the water. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally about 20 million to one. Or where I live, I live in the forest, and I oftentimes walk through the forest at night without a lantern or anything. And there's bears up there. I was like, oh my God, aren't you scared? There's bears. I mean, they're like big and, you know. And there's about one person dies in North America every year because of a black bear attack. And let's contrast that with, I believe it's 42,000 Americans die every year in automobile wrecks. And I believe it's about the same number die every year from the health results, the direct result of automobile emissions. And so, I mean, you know, it's like bears. I mean, well, who the f*** is scared of a bear? I mean, we should walk through a parking lot going, oh my God, stay away. Between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. And, I mean, I'm sorry, didn't we hear about that? But at the same time, any time a cop dies, it's like, there's a big state funeral with, you know, some gave all gave some, with the bumper stickers. You know, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Way, way, way more dangerous than cops. And when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for a garbage collector, you know, or bumper stickers? Some gave all gave some.
Thomas Friedman says that McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, meaning the U.S. Air Force.
I was invited to Washington, D.C. to attend this meeting that was being put together by the National Security Agency called the Critical Thinking Consortium. I remember standing there in this room and looking over on one side of the room, and we had CIA, NSA, DIA, FBI, Customs, Secret Service. And then on the other side of the room, we had Coca-Cola, Mobil Oil, GTE, and Kodak. And I remember thinking, I am like in the epicenter of the intelligence industry right now. I mean, the line is not just blurring, it's just not there anymore.
But don't you sometimes need big government to deal with big business, that in a sense there is a kind of balance between these large forces?
It's like saying there's a balance between two members of the board of directors of General Motors. Yes, there's some kind of a balance, but they're so closely interlinked and they're connected that they're, to first approximation, they're the same thing.
Of course, this doesn't mean that some governments are not better than others, or that governments cannot offer a certain degree of protection against market forces. It doesn't mean that the public cannot have a certain degree of democratic influence over government, or that they cannot have more influence over government than they do over totally undemocratic institutions like corporations. After all, most of the freedoms that we enjoy in the West have been the product of successful grassroots struggles, like the civil rights movement the labor movement, the women's movement, etc., which were able to influence and constrain governments, corporations, and other elite institutions, which subsequently took credit for the freedoms gained by these struggles. What it means is that freedoms are usually not a gift from above, and that when they are either incidental or they foster dependence and subordination, creating hierarchy. Government, whether it calls itself Republican, Democrat, Socialist, Capitalist, Communist, or whatever, is a means by which a minority controls a majority, either by itself or in conjunction with other powerful entities like corporations. Here, the concept of property is important. Having property for personal use and need, like a home, a bed, a toothbrush, etc., does not require government, but when one's private property extends beyond those items to the means of production, like industries, large swaths of land, or any property that is not for personal use, then the need for government appears. When property is used to deprive others of access to the basic necessities of life, or when property is used to derive profit at the expense of others without having to work, simply by granting permission to use the means of production, then the need for government appears.
Till there be property, there can be no government, the very end of which is to secure wealth and to defend the rich from the poor.
The great and chief end of men's uniting into commonwealths and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property.
Those who own the country ought to govern it.
Government ought to be so constituted as to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority.
Society could be managed without the state. And by the state, I don't mean the absence of any institutions, the absence of any form of social organization. The state really refers to a professional apparatus of people who are set aside to manage society, to preempt the control of society from the people.
You know, the people are being asked to die and pay for this, and you're saying they have no say.
No, I didn't say that, Helen, but Helen, this president was elected.
It amounts to it, you'd say we have no input at all.
No, the president, you had input. The American people have input every 4 years, and that's the way our system
every
is set
years.
Up.
It is only natural that those on top of the hierarchy will try to limit public input by creating conflict and division. That is, by promoting unity only as it relates to a uniform support for elite ideology and action. And it's only natural that violence and deceit will be used to suppress the freedom instinct of the masses. After all, if the subordinate majority ever unite, elite power could be jeopardized. In fact, not only do power structures create situations where we oppress each other, but they create situations where we defend and become attached to our own oppressors. In other words, those at the top of a hierarchy become part of us, like an extension of our egos. The most obvious example of a hierarchical power structure having this effect is the state. Worship of the state has become a secular religion for which the intellectuals serve as a priesthood. The more primitive sectors of society go further, fostering forms of idolatry in which such sacred symbols as the flag become an object of forced veneration, while God and state are linked in public ceremony and discourse. But the state is not the only major hierarchical organization with control over our lives.
Every institution provides the people who are members of it with a social role to occupy. And typically, institutions that are vibrant and have a lot of power will specify that role in some sense as a list of virtues. It's true for churches, for schools, for any institution that has power over people and shapes them.
One nation.
The corporation, likewise, it provides us with a list of virtues, a kind of social role, which is the good consumer.
Like the waters of a mighty ocean, people also represent a tremendous force, the understanding of which is of greatest importance to the American way of life. This force is known as consumer power.
The goal for the corporations is to maximize profit and market share, and they also have a goal for their target, namely the population. They have to be turned into